Welcome to Pop Culture on the Apricot Tree, where we talk about gospel insights through great stories and help you find entertainment that's both true and beautiful. Pop Culture on the Apricot Tree is part of the Public Square Media network of podcasts that seek to bring an LDS perspective into the public square. I'm your host, Liz Busby. I'm a writer of science fiction and fantasy, a reviewer of books, and a Latter-day Saint. And with me today is not my co-host, Carl. He's running a little bit late. As Carl mentioned in our last episode, his wife had a baby. And so things are a little crazy at Carl's house. So hopefully he's going to join us partway through this episode, but we're missing Carl at the beginning. We have two guests with us today, so hopefully we can keep the conversation going without Carl. Joseph, can you introduce yourself to us?
Sure. My name's Joseph Eddington, a student of political science at BYU, and I love literature and particularly Les Mis, which is my favorite book. And the musical is also great.
We connected on Twitter. You said, if you ever do a Les Mis episode, we got to get me on there. And so here we are. And then our second guest is Jim Bennett. Jim, can you introduce yourself?
Sure. My name's Jim Bennett, and I'm a recovering actor and a former artistic director of the Tuakon Center for the Arts. I also was a pop culture columnist for the Deseret News for 5 years. And I am fighting a nasty cold here at the moment, so I sound more rugged than usual.
It's great. We add some audio variety to our podcast. And as was mentioned, today we're going to be talking about Les Miserables, specifically the 2012 film version of the classic musical about the French Revolution and justice versus mercy, starring Hugh Jackman, Russell Crowe, Anne Hathaway, all the big ones. But first, we're going to do our best book segment, where we each recommend one thing we're watching, reading, or listening to. My recommendation today is a funny little book that I just zoomed through this last month called Once Upon a Prime, The Wondrous Connection Between Mathematics and Literature by Sarah Hart. I am a geek of both literature and mathematics. I majored in English at BYU, but I also minored in chemistry. So I enjoy both the humanities and the more analytical sciences. And it's always interesting to me to look at where those two things overlap. So this book is by a professor of mathematics in the UK, but she talks about all the ways that mathematics overlaps with literature. So she covers things like rhyme schemes and poetry, meter in different languages. So lots of interesting things there, but then also weird forms of books that are mathematical plot lines. She talks about Flatland. She talks about Tolstoy's calculus metaphor in War and Peace. She runs the gamut of things that are relating mathematics and literature, which a lot of people think are very different, but they're more related than you would think because language involves a lot of patterns and so does math. So it's a really fun book. If you enjoy either of those things, I think you will find it a really interesting read. And that's called Once Upon a Prime by Sarah Hart. Joseph, what have you got to recommend for us today?
All right, today I'm going to recommend Till We Have Faces by C.S. Lewis. I absolutely love the book. It's one of my favorites, and I only had even heard of it recently. It's not a very well-known book by C.S. Lewis, who's obviously most known for, when writing fiction, The Chronicles of Narnia. This is nothing like The Chronicles of Narnia, although it is still focused on myth and folktale. It is actually a retelling of the Greek myth of Cupid and Psyche. And it's a particularly interesting book, in my opinion, because it was the first book that C.S. Lewis ever started writing back when he was still an atheist before he converted to Christianity. And it was the last novel that he finished. And it is, in my opinion, his best work. It's, in essence, a book about the question of divine hiddenness. If God exists, if he loves us, if he is powerful, why can we not know him? Why is it not more obvious that he's present in our lives and in the universe? And it's just an absolutely fantastic piece of literature. The characterization is outstanding, and it's really a very thought-provoking and inspiring book. So I think more people should read it.
I definitely agree. I'm a huge C.S. Lewis fan. And Till We Have Faces is just a whole nother level of C.S. Lewis work. I listen to a C.S. Lewis podcast called Pints with Jack. If you don't know, C.S. Lewis went by Jack.
Better than Clive.
Yes, indeed. You have limited choices when your name is Clive Staples. But there was recently a ballet version of Till We Have Faces put on in Chicago, which is super interesting. And they used lots of screens to show reflections and things. It sounds really interesting. I wish I could go see it. If you have read Narnia and want to read a grown-up version, Till We Have Faces is amazing. Jim, what have you got to share with us today?
I'm two-thirds of the way done with a book called Shakespeare Was a Woman and Other Heresies by Elizabeth Winkler. I've spent my life obsessed with the Shakespeare authorship question, which a lot of people consider to be a tinfoil hat conspiracy theory. And I don't believe that it is. And Elizabeth Winkler is a journalist for The Atlantic who found herself admired in this when she wrote an article called Shakespeare Was a Woman and discovered that all of these literary ivory tower types got really angry with her and discovered that this was a taboo subject to even discuss. So she decided to write a book-length version of this. And for anybody who's at all acquainted with the Shakespeare authorship question or doesn't even know what it is, this is a great layman's introduction to it. And I'm really enjoying it.
That is so interesting. It's an interesting question that I don't know if we'll ever get a complete answer to historically. I wonder, have you ever read The Air Affair by Jasper Ford?
I have not.
Okay, so this is like a really weird speculative fiction alternate history book. But the thing that's the most interesting about it for this conversation is that it's set in a world where people really care about literature. And so missionaries go from door to door trying to convert people to who they think Shakespeare really is. They're knocking on doors. Have you heard the good word about how Bacon was actually the author of Shakespeare's plays? I mean, it's really hilarious.
That sounds like fun. I should take a look.
It's a very silly book. Also involves going into literature. Thus, it's the Eyre affair because she has to save Jane Eyre. Somebody goes in and messes up the Jane Eyre plot line and the last half of the book is gone. So she has to go in and fix it. So it's quite amusing, but I always, whenever I hear of the Shakespeare authorship debate, think of those missionaries going from door to door. Hey, this is Liz from the future dropping in. Carl wanted to jump in and record his best book segment, even though in the recording of the podcast, he's not here yet. So Carl, what have you got for us today?
So I recently read a really interesting book called A Deadly Education by Naomi Novik. It's a young adult book that suffers from some of the problems of young adult books I don't enjoy. But basically, the author wanted to say, what if there was a magical school that took student safety more seriously than Hogwarts did? And what would that look like? And then, by her own admission, she went a little overboard. Because in this universe, there are creatures that eat mana, and they come after magic users, and so, like, kids who are just coming into their magic powers basically have like a 95% death rate. And so they decide to put them in a school where you go to the school, like, which is in its own pocket universe for 4 years. And the school is basically sentient and it gives you all of your coursework and grades things and gives you the texts and the spells to learn and everything. And you just stay there for 4 years while there are creatures who sneak in as best they can to try to get at the students inside. And then at the end, they just open the gates and you have to run through like a horde of magic-eating creatures to try to get out. And 25% of the students survive that. So the wizards of the world decide 1 in 4 is still better odds than 1 in 20. So we're going to throw our kids into this horrible school. But it was fun and I enjoyed it. Hogwarts didn't take student safety seriously. And I feel like this is a genre misalignment where the fun thing about Hogwarts and Harry Potter is that these wild, crazy things happen. You just go to the infirmary and they'll fix you up and it's fine. And that's the fun and delight of it. And in this one, it's like, no, if that sort of stuff happened, people would be maimed for life or dead. And so we're going to take that seriously. It feels a little bit to me like George R.R. Martin trying to critique Tolkien by saying, this is unrealistic. I'm going to make something really realistic, and then outspits Game of Thrones. But I found it delightful. The main character is someone who has prophesied to destroy the world. And so the school keeps giving her these really evil tomes of magic. And she's, I just want to clean up my room. Stop giving me spell to raise an army of undead or enslave all the other students so they can clean the room for me. I just want a cleaning spell. And it's really interesting. And I enjoyed it. And I'm in the middle of the second one now where she starts her senior year at the Scholomance. And so A Deadly Education by Naomi Novik is my recommendation this time.
I've read the first two of those as well. They are very interesting, very different.
Yeah, but fun.
Very fun, yes, in their own way. And now we'll return to our regularly recorded episode. So we'll have links to all these recommendations on our website, popcultureapricottree.com, and buying through these links helps support our podcast so we can keep bringing you conversations about the true and the beautiful in pop culture. And now we're going to go on to our main discussion of Les Mis, the film version. But I thought we might first do a little bit of background on Les Mis. I was talking to our guests before we started the episode about how Les Mis was one of the first plays I ever went to, one of the first big plays. I did regional theater things, little small plays that were for kids. But when I was old enough, when I was 13 or whatever, my parents were like, okay, you're ready. You can go see Les Mis. And they took me to a production of Les Mis, I think at a Bravenel Hall in Utah. And that's the first play I really remember seeing. And I feel like it's an important play in a lot of people's lives, especially in Utah. And I know Jim has been around in the Utah theater scene. So I thought you could give us some commentary on the relationship between Les Mis and Utah and Mormonism. Like, why do we keep producing this play? Do we produce it more than other places here in Utah?
I think we do. It's only relatively recently that it's been available for amateur productions. And the first time I saw it, actually, we honeymooned through Europe. And I saw it on the West End on my honeymoon. And we had just arrived in London the day before. And I have to confess, I fell asleep because of jet lag. I didn't see it again until it was produced at the Utah Shakespeare Festival a couple decades later. And Tuacon has done it. Hale Center Theater did a very popular version of it, where Javert, when he jumps off the bridge, he jumps down into this pit, into the mist, and everybody gasped because the actor actually jumped into a 20, 30-foot pit that had cushions down at the bottom where he was safe.
The effects that they could do at Hale Center are just mind-boggling sometimes. In such a small, intimate theater, they do cool stuff. I went to their production of Little Mermaid, and it was nuts.
The one in Sandy is genuinely probably the most elaborate theatrical facility in the world. They had to get the people who built Cirque du Soleil to come and build it because the kinds of materials that they have to use and all the things that they had to do in order to allow for those kinds of special effects are not something you can just pull off the shelf. Musical theater seems to be the artistic vehicle of expression for Latter-day Saints to a large degree. And we go through favorite musicals, anything that has a religious bent. Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat for decades and decades was at the top of the list. And I think maybe Les Mis has replaced it. But it's that kind of uplifting spiritual message that Latter-day Saints crave, that they're looking for in their entertainment. And Les Mis fits the bill so well. And I think that's the reason why it's so popular.
I don't know if this is apocryphal, but I feel like when they came out with the high school version of Les Mis, that it was produced in Utah first. I remember reading something about that, but I could not find any news stories on it online, so maybe I'm just remembering wrong. So don't quote me on that. But I know my brother-in-law played Jean Valjean in his high school production. Like, it's definitely very popular around here. I personally have not read the book, but Joseph, what do you think about how the musical compares to the book version? The book is a classic of world literature.
Yeah, I probably have a pretty unique relationship with Les Mis because I read the book a few times before I ever saw the musical.
Oh, interesting.
I first read the book as a sophomore in high school. We spent an entire semester of my sophomore honors English class, and all we did for that entire semester was read Les Mis. And it is probably the only worthwhile book I ever read in an English class in high school, honestly. But it was so impactful on me that it made a pretty huge difference and it became my favorite book. And I saw the musical only a couple years ago. The experience, of course, is very different. The music is fantastic. By virtue of the medium, there's only so much you can compress from a book that's 1,400 pages long down into a musical that runs a couple of hours. And a lot of it tends to exaggerate the dramatic plot lines in Les Mis, the French Revolution plot line, especially. is exaggerated in terms of the importance of the plot. A lot of Les Mis, the book, is very dedicated to the internal moral evolution of Jean Valjean as a character and the internal moral evolution of Marius as a character. And that's not something that we can really see on screen just because it doesn't translate very well. You would have to spend a lot more time on it in order to get the kind of effect that Hugo can do in the book by talking about their internal experiences directly. And so the effect is pretty different in that it tends to foreground the political movement and the interpersonal interactions much more than is in the book, which is primarily a very spiritual look at Jean Valjean as a man through the stages of his life.
I feel like the film version was a lot more spiritual even than the stage musical version. Most of the versions of Les Mis I've seen have a more minimalistic set. And in the film version, you can have him singing his conversion song, essentially, in this cathedral before the altar. And you have the iconography of Christ on the cross there. And they return to the church in the end. It felt a lot more Christian. And so you're saying that is definitely in the book, that it's more of a spiritual book. Sometimes the musical feels a little bit more about the social issues than about the spiritual issues.
Yeah, and it's difficult to understand the way that Hugo, because Hugo was not a very orthodox Christian, and he had very mixed feelings about the Catholic Church. And so Hugo was a very spiritual man, but he was not particularly religious. And in the book, he speaks pretty equivocally of the Catholic Church, actually. His great hero is the Bishop of Digne. Of course, we see that a little bit in the beginning of the musical, but the bishop is notable precisely because he does not fit with the norm of the Catholic clergy and the Catholic Church in France, as Hugo saw it.
The church is basically there at the beginning of the musical and then just is gone the rest of the time. Like, we don't see any kind of other interaction with the church after that, really. But it's more about Jean Valjean's internal spiritual relationship with God and with justice and mercy rather than with any kind of institutional church. So the one complaint I always hear about the book is that there's a lot of French politics and people are like, I just skipped that part. Is it worth reading the full version? Or I know there are abridged versions that kind of bring it up to date for modern sensibilities of pacing and things.
So if you're going to choose between not reading the book and reading the abridged version, you should read the abridged version. But if you enjoy prose at all, you should read the full version. Victor Hugo is a good enough writer that he can spend 20 pages writing about the history of the sewer system in Paris, and it is a delight to read, even though it really has absolutely nothing to do with the main plot. Hugo is probably one of the greatest prose stylists that ever lived, and it's good enough that, you know, you can read him writing about random digressions pleasurably, even in translation in English, where there is no way that you could match his native French style. So if you enjoy literature, I think that you would probably enjoy reading the full version, although it will take a lot of time because Hugo is very wordy.
Okay. I need to put it on my list. I've been working my way this year through a couple of long books, but they were both Russian. I finished War and Peace, and now I'm doing Brothers Karamazov. And maybe I'm ready to not be in Russian literature anymore, so maybe I'll try Hugo next.
Les Mis tends to be a lot more accessible to modern readers because French politics is much more comprehensible to modern peoples than Russian politics. Hugo is what I would consider the archetype of high liberalism, whereas War and Peace is set in a Russia that is still essentially mired in feudalism and ways of thinking that are just completely alien to us, that it's very difficult for us to get in the mindset of those people. Whereas the French revolutionaries are relatively easy for us to understand, even if we may not necessarily agree with them.
I think there's a misconception sometimes that the French Revolution and the American Revolution are very similar, but Although you did have liberty as like this underlying thing, they have different characters, I feel. And especially the French Revolution continues over several years, interrupted by Napoleon and the return of the monarchy. And then we get this ending part of the French Revolution, which is portrayed in Les Mis.
The French Revolution was a very radical revolution. The American Revolution was a very conservative revolution.
Let's dive into actually discussing this movie version. What did you think of the film version of the Les Mis musical? Jim, have you got thoughts on how they translated the musical to a movie?
Anytime you transfer a musical to film, it's a challenge because it's much harder to suspend disbelief that you're living in a universe where everybody is singing. And particularly with a musical like Les Mis that's sung through, it becomes difficult. And I found the choice to record live vocals on site to be deeply distracting from that, because it was trying to inject this kind of realism into a very unreal kind of universe. And Jean Valjean is tromping through the sewers and he's singing. Why is he singing in this world where sewers stink, there's all this dirt and everything, a very realistic, gritty world that doesn't match with the kind of suspension of disbelief that is necessary when you're dealing with a musical? So I did not really like the film adaptation of it. There was a lot of criticism of Russell Crowe's vocals particularly. And yeah, I don't think Russell Crowe can sing, but that wasn't my biggest problem with it. My biggest problem with it was the difficulty of suspending disbelief in a universe where everybody is singing, and it just didn't work. It just didn't hang together for me.
Now we have Carl joining us. Hi, Carl. We're just barely starting the film discussion, so you're right on time.
Okay, good.
I'm going to build off of what Jim just said. Yeah, I am not an expert in musicals or singing, but I definitely noticed that when I first saw the musical in theaters, that it doesn't feel the same. There's like the echo of the musical there, but you don't get the same soaring power that you get with these iconic Les Mis songs. And when I mentioned to some people that we were recording an episode on Les Mis, two different people shared with me the famous YouTube breakdown of why the singing is not great and of this choice to record the music live. Because if you're used to watching old recorded musicals, they would record the music in a studio and then lip sync as they were acting out the scene. So you're used to getting this full-throated performance while you're also seeing them dance in The King and I. So they're dancing and they're still being able to keep their breath and hold these big, long notes. And that is not at all how it is in Les Mis. It's very breathy. And there's Anne Hathaway's choice to, on purpose, mess up her song, I Dreamed a Dream, because she's like, well, the character wouldn't be singing in this situation. She'd be distressed. And so she's like crying, sobbing her way through it, which is very affecting from an acting point of view, but it's not really a good choice from a singing point of view. So we'll definitely link to that YouTube video in the show notes about all the different reasons why the recording live did not maybe go as well as you would hope if you enjoy the music part of Les Mis.
If you're thinking of the same video I am, I also discovered that video independently in doing my research, if it's the same video, and I agree with all of their assessments, but I have to say, because they were singing it live, the acting in this movie is on point. There's a depth to it that I don't think any other musical that I've seen, and I'm not an expert in all this sort of stuff. That's more my wife's department as far as movies we like. But it was very arresting to me and very moving to see them singing live to each other in the moment and being able to act with each other and build off each other as opposed to just trying to lip sync to the thing they had done 3 months earlier. That was something that I really enjoyed about the movie, is seeing the acting because they were doing it live. The music suffered, but the acting did not. So weigh that as you will.
And I think it made the story much more traumatic. When you're doing a musical version of such an intense story where you have just grinding poverty and tragedy and people being killed for a cause, the music can tend to gloss over that because you're enjoying this great soliloquy and the high notes and just the like power and the repeated themes. And you get wrapped up in that and you forget that this is people dying. This is people being forced into prostitution. This is like not a happy story. And so I feel like there was a little bit of shock going into watching this movie musical and being like, oh, this is like a hard story. This is not we're going out to the theater after enjoying our trip to New York and we're going to a Broadway play and it's going to be fun and then we're going to go home and have a great time. It really made you think about the issues that are being presented.
Yeah, I am not an expert in musical theater either, but I do think the acting as opposed to the singing was really the strong point. And I think that's more faithful to Hugo's vision. He wrote Les Mis essentially both as a paean to the common people of France, but also as a call to action. It is supposed to say, we have these problems in our society, and unless we fix them, we are morally culpable for the results that we are seeing. And so we need to understand both the problems and our responsibility. And so the choice to really foreground the acting, and so to foreground the tragedy that is really happening, I think is a very interesting, and I think it is a good choice, even if it does sacrifice the music somewhat. But you can always listen to the music from the Broadway shows if you want that.
It's problematic because there are film versions of Les Mis that are not a musical. I film the musical version if you're not going to focus on the music and if you don't understand that, like, that's the method of the storytelling is the music itself and the repetition of these themes that you hear the echoes over and over again. It's a baffling choice, but still exciting to see it on film if it was something you grew up with and you loved. In 2012, when this movie came out, my brother was just coming home from a mission. And so my parents, loving the Les Mis musical, took him to this as his first movie back. And he kind of bounced off of it. It was a bit of a culture shock because it is very dire. I'm thinking especially of the Fantine scenes of Anne Hathaway as a newly returned missionary. That was really tough for him to watch. And just, they really get into the gritty realism of the things that happen to people when they are in poverty and the impossible choices they have to make.
I think any movie right after your mission is going to be a trauma. I know it was for me. And the first movie I saw after my mission was Dirty Rotten Scoundrels with Steve Martin and Michael Caine. And I saw it with my parents, and they thought it was hysterical. And I just thought, my parents are going to hell. How dare they? So that's a different mindset for anybody. It's interesting to me to see that, to a large degree, the movie musical as a genre is dead. Every now and then you have a movie like Les Mis, or you have something else that tries to revive it. But the only way you see those kinds of movies now are in essentially animated films or adaptations of animated films. The Little Mermaid now is heating up the cinemas, but that's an adaptation of an animated movie. And musicals, again, lend themselves to that kind of fantasy and to that kind of thing. And Les Mis is this sort of awkward stepchild that isn't really quite one or the other. It can't decide if it's going to be the kind of fantasy that most musicals are, or if it's going to embrace the kind of realism that is inherent in the story. And so it tries to straddle the line, and at least in my estimation, doesn't succeed at either one.
I'm thinking also about probably the most successful recent movie musical, I would say, is Hamilton. Hamilton did really well, but is it a movie musical because it's a film stage production? So it's almost going full circle from these musical productions in the 50s and 60s, all the Rodgers and Hammerstein ones that were not filmed stage productions. They were fully produced things. And then we went to Les Mis, which was trying to be more of a movie than a musical. And now we're like, let's just film the stage production of Hamilton because any kind of attempt to add realism would be less than what you get with the filmed stage version because it's an essentially different medium.
And I think the fact that Hamilton was willing to just embrace what it is and say, this is a film stage production, I think that's one of the reasons why it succeeded on film, is that the audience is able to temper its expectations. And they're not asking to see George Washington and Alexander Hamilton on the Revolutionary War battlefield. They're on a stage, and they recognize that. They recognize the differences from that, and they're able to adjust their expectations accordingly. And Les Mis didn't do that. And so I thought it was awkward as a result. Am I terrible that I'm not gushing over this film, that I should love it?
No, I wouldn't gush over it either. It's a question of genre, right? You have going to the theater to see a musical on the spectrum, and then there is going to the theater to just see the Broadway people sing the songs, but they're not doing any of the acting. They just walk up to the microphone and sing. And then you have this, which is in the middle of the spectrum. And then on the other side, you have something more like The Little Mermaid, where they sing it ahead of time and then lip sync it when they video it. And then on the far end of the spectrum, you have any movie that is just Les Mis itself, not the musical, just the story. And there are some wonderful movie adaptations. Where your personal sensibilities on that spectrum lie is a live question. I, for one, am grateful that this one exists, because I think I got something different out of this because of watching Anne Hathaway deliberately screw up, especially those songs, as she's falling into despair because of all the situation that has happened to her and wanting Cosette to have a better life, but being unable to do anything about it. And just, it was heart-wrenching, and it made me appreciate the music, even though the music was terrible in some ways, more, because I understood a little bit more of what was going on behind it. As to whether that makes the entire movie worth it or not, that's a live question. But I, for one, am glad that there is this one example. Sure, there should be one in all of cinema where they sang it live, and it's this one. And maybe a failed experiment, but I'm happy to see people try new things. And I did get something out of this, even if they had done it the regular way. I'd probably been like, yeah, that was a better movie overall. But this one, because the acting was good, I really got something unique out of that. And I'm glad for that.
Another scale is the scale from musical to opera. And I feel like Les Mis is moving along that towards the opera, right? Because there are almost no spoken lines. I feel like even in the movie, they added some spoken lines that maybe weren't in the original script, because it is literally just songs all the way through, much more in an operatic style than your classic musicals that would get produced into a movie musical where there's acting and talking, and then we'll do a song at the emotional climax. And then when that's too much, we'll dance. There's no dance numbers in Les Mis. That's not a thing.
I'd be curious, has anybody watched the Apple TV show Schmigadoon?
Well, if I can obnoxiously name drop, I was at the University of Southern California when Cinco Paul was at the University of California, Los Angeles, at UCLA. He's a member of the church. He's the creator of Schmigadoon. And I did a student film for him at one point. And he, even back then, was talking about this idea of making a world where people are trapped in musicals. And I've watched both season one and season two, absolutely love them, adore them. And season three has not been announced yet. And they're in the midst of a writer's strike that Cinco Paul is on the front lines of. But I think a season three, the logical next step is to go into those big 80s musicals and have Les Miserables, or Les Schmiserables, if you will. I think that's the next logical step. So if I were talking to Cinco, I haven't spoken to him in decades, but if I were talking to him, that's what I would pitch.
Schmantum of the Opera, maybe?
Schmantum of the Opera, Schmatz, all those big 80s sung through musicals. I think that's the next step for that series.
So if you're not familiar with Schmigadoon, the premise is that this couple gets pulled into this fantasy world that's a musical. And the first season is based on like the early Rodgers and Hammerstein musicals. There's Music Man. There's like Oklahoma in there. And then the second season is based on Chicago and
Brigadoon, obviously.
I have to warn sensitive viewers that there is a considerable amount of sexual innuendo and content, especially the second season. That's why I stopped the second season. But Jim, you're saying it's worth it if you're a musical fan.
The second season, it really, I think, walks that line very well, but tries to combine. There's one song that Sweeney Todd, for instance, as a musical, was very dark subject material.
Yeah.
And there's a song that essentially is a parody of both Sweeney Todd and Annie, where young orphan children talk about how delightful they would be to eat. I thought, this is, in one breath, the most cheerful and the darkest song I have ever heard in my entire life. It's just hysterical. And there's no nudity that I can recall. It flirts with and suggests the kind of darkness that you see in these 70s musicals, but it never fully gets there. I wouldn't be nervous about showing it to anybody, but I may be more heretical and awful than you are. So take what's worth.
The thing I loved about the first season, though, is that the wife loves musicals and the husband is, oh, no. Oh, no. Why are we here? And that's me and my husband. My husband is like, why are we watching these? He loves Les Mis. He will watch Les Mis and he's okay with Hamilton. But pretty much other than that, he's, no, why are we doing this? So I felt that spirit. If you're in a couple that's mixed about musicals, it's quite amusing.
See, Susan didn't even suggest that I watch Schmigadoon with her. She was just like, this is going to be one of my shows. And I was like, that's fine. I'll go watch Black Bear or something.
There you go. Totally healthy. We haven't gotten much into the actual themes of Les Mis. And I feel like the film style definitely lent more to a discussion of the theme of poverty, right? Like, you can see just the grinding poverty that not only the main characters, but just the crowd songs that people are going through in France at this time. And Joseph, when you were talking about how Hugo wrote this novel to bring awareness to this issue and be like, you are all responsible, you know what's happening, it reminded me of Charles Dickens, right? Because he was a similar thing for England, being like, I'm going to write this amusing novel and people will have funny names and be stereotyped characters. But the point of this novel is that industrialization is killing people and we are turning a blind eye to it. And I'm going to write this compelling novel that forces you to notice the problems that are going on in our society so that you will do something. My question is, after watching Les Mis, what is the thing that it is saying we can do? Or what should we do? What kind of message is it saying about how we deal with issues of poverty and massive inequality, which are very relevant to today?
The movie itself is very much drawing attention, yes, to the plight of the poor. Unfortunately, I don't feel like it does a good job, and I don't know if it could do a good job of highlighting Hugo's attempt to solve this. Hugo is what I would consider the archetype of the high liberal. He believes in the perfection of humanity through progress and specifically through education. In the book, Hugo talks about how all sin and all crime is caused by ignorance. And so his idea was that universal education could ultimately eradicate crime and poverty altogether. And so in many ways, he was a little bit of a quasi-socialist. He had certainly socialist sympathies, even though he wasn't doctrinaire by any sense. But he did believe in not just in providing help for the poor, but that by establishing a program of universal education, then the poor could be lifted out of poverty and ignorance entirely, and essentially that humanity could be perfected in this way through education. Because people would be able not only to provide for themselves physically, but also to provide for themselves spiritually, which is another way that Hugo was concerned with poverty, not just the material desperation that it brings about, but the fact that it tends to accompany the moral degradation, which prevents people from achieving their spiritual potential as well. In the movie or the musical, I don't know that this is as clear. Certainly there's the idea of the French Revolution. It's not clear in the musical exactly what they are fighting for and what they want.
Just in reading up on everything for this podcast episode, I did not realize before now that this isn't the full-blown French Revolution. This is like a very specific thing, the June Rebellion, that lasted for 2 days, and that was it, right? Like, maybe it's part of the broader thing that's going on in France at the time, but I had until now always assumed that this was the dramatized version of the kickoff of the full-blown French Revolution. It's not. And that changes the way I view what's going on, because it seems ultimately very futile now, to my mind, what they're doing in setting up these barricades and hijacking the funeral of this general and all sorts of things that are going on. Something that I think the movie does really well and was, again, very moving to me is just that line as Valjean is dying and going to heaven. Fantine is taking him and walking away from his body as the two younger characters are crying over him as he's just passed. And he walks towards and sees the bishop, who is, I forget if he played Valjean or Javert in the original Broadway, that particular.
Valjean.
Valjean, okay.
In the 25th anniversary one, I think.
Walking towards the bishop, and there's just that great line. And I don't know if the play or the movie or the musical are all necessarily trying to address, or how well they're doing to address, the themes that are brought up in the book, the reason why it was written in the first place, but to look at someone in all of their despair and their poverty and all the bad choices they've made and all the nonsense and shenanigans that happen here in this mortality, to see them and to love them the way the bishop did, even though he's, in all the versions, he's a bit character. He shows at the beginning, but then obviously the ripples of his decision to let him take candlesticks ripple forward through the rest of the story. But to see him approaching the cathedral and the bishop singing and the whole thing was very moving to me. And whether you think poverty should be addressed by means of socialism, like Hugo did, or if you want to take a more libertarian approach, there are good faith discussions to be had about how we handle all of these situations. The poor are always among us, but to love another person is to see the face of God. It was very moving to me to see that portrayed so well, and something in all these discussions we should not lose sight of that was brought home very powerfully to me in watching the ending of this particular iteration of Les Mis. In all the political discussions, don't lose sight of that fact. We're talking about children of God, and if you have done it to the least of these, you have done it unto me, is a powerful theme we should all keep in mind.
And that's, I think, really like the starting point for Hugo. That's why the book is called Les Misérables. It is, we have to look to the poor. We have to understand the poor. We have to love the poor. And at that point, then we can consider the kind of solutions that need to be done. But before we can solve the problems of the poor, we must love them for what they are.
Yeah, I think the musical is definitely a bit more ambiguous on the societal level of how do we solve this. I almost felt like it was hopeless, because at the end, the solution is we all die and end up in heaven, and then there's hope. The final musical number is like, yay, we're in heaven and everything's great now. And that's the solution. So to me, it felt hopeless on the societal level, which is maybe not what Hugo was going for. But on the individual level, it's unambiguous that, like, you should help people, even if it is inconvenient for you. If it changes your entire life. Jean Valjean is running away from the law. He's trying not to get caught. And in the midst of all this, there's a girl who needs his help, who he's arguably tangentially responsible for. It would be much easier for him to be on the run without a daughter, but he chooses to sacrifice for her, and it is worth it. Cosette is the only one who goes from scraping poverty to a much more middle-class, upper-class life in this musical. Like, she's the only one, and the reason that she does is because one person reaches out to one person. That's the solution that I saw in Les Mis, that, like, the societal problems are difficult and intractable and hard, but the individual problems are easy. It is give. The other, like, huge theme in here, of course, is justice and mercy, which we have in the characters of Jean Valjean and Javert, like this idea of, should we judge a person by the one moment of weakness in their life, or should we give people second chances? And I think sometimes it can be tempting to be like, Javert's an extreme version of this. This is obviously a very extreme version of, you stole one loaf of bread, so for the rest of your life, you should be a criminal and no one should give you a job or ever forgive you. What do you think about the portrayal of justice and mercy in this film, in this musical, in this book? Is that realistic of how justice and mercy are opposites of each other? Is there maybe more nuance that we need?
I think one of the most powerful moments in the book, in the musical and everything, is when Jean Valjean shows mercy to Javert, to the point where Javert is so undone by it that he can't continue living. That, to me, is such an extraordinarily powerful insight into the power of mercy, into what mercy can do for us, and how we need to be willing to accept it when it comes. And Javert's sense of justice is so keen that he can't live in a world where mercy is able to overpower justice. I see Les Miserables in many ways as Javert's story as much as it is Jean Valjean's. And Jean Valjean is able to progress and grow and learn and improve, and Javert is not. And then when he's given an opportunity to say, your entire life has been devoted to something that is incorrect, that is wrong. You've been trying to hold Jean Valjean responsible and accountable for something for which he has repented and paid a price and has moved on from. And that was the wrong thing to do. And Javert's only option that he sees is suicide. And so I see those two sort of parallel stories as being the thematic center of the story overall. And justice and mercy is very much at the center of what happens here.
I think the interesting thing, especially about Javert's story in particular, is that the musical tries to portray this by having Javert sing about the fixedness of the stars, for example. But Javert essentially was a very religious man whose faith was in the state and law and order. And what Jean Valjean actually did in the book is he provoked Javert into a crisis of faith by his extension of mercy, where Javert saw that there is a higher law above the state and above public order, that there can be, you know, criminals, those who have been rejected by society and judged by the state as unworthy of participation in public life, that can be more saintly, greater people than a policeman. And to Javert, this was a revelation, but an unacceptable one. He had dedicated his life to serving what he saw as the highest good, preserving the public order of society for the citizens. And actually, when Javert submits his resignation to Jean Valjean as Monsieur Le Maire for having falsely accused him and having attempted to report him for being a convict, which he felt was an absolute offense to civil order to make a false accusation. When he commits suicide, he's saying this is him sending his resignation into God, because he feels that by his life, he has insulted his superior. He has broken the new heavenly law, which has been revealed to him as being above public order. And his only way that he can contemplate of submitting resignation to God is committing suicide.
Which is part of the tragedy of the character of Javert, is because he is shown this higher law, but he demonstrates his unwillingness to even attempt to try to live it. So, Jim, you said he had wasted his life, or I forget exactly how you phrased it, but law and order and punishment and crime, I don't think we want to say like those are bad virtues, but certainly Javert is ridiculously overzealous in his application of those themes. And when he finds himself unable to move past them at all, that shows a bit of a tragedy. Valjean, he's stealing a loaf of bread so his nephew doesn't starve to death. Seems pretty noble to me, against the order of law, certainly, but I think most of the human race is, okay, that's fine. Javert is not. But you see him evolve and change and see, even though society has tried to grind him down and gave him 19 years in a labor camp, he becomes a very different kind of person. And Javert never becomes a different kind of person. And the juxtaposition of these two together shows you the tragedy of what it means to be so overzealous in a particular cause, such that when you discover a higher way, you are unbendable and cannot change. What's the funny axiom? Blessed are the flexible, for they shall not be bent out of shape. Seems to apply to Javert.
I'm also thinking about the contrast between Jean Valjean and the innkeeper and his wife, the Thénardiers. I think this musical, like, they were my least favorite characters as a kid. Like, I could not stand all the innkeeper songs. I was like, these people are awful people. Why are they in this musical? But I think you can see why they are necessary characters here, because they are a contrast to Jean Valjean, where Jean Valjean stole to preserve life. They're stealing for personal gain all the time, constantly stealing for personal gain. The contrast between those two says, yes, law and order is necessary at some point. Like, these people are despicable bad people, and we should enforce the laws against them. But it is also saying, overall, nuanced version, that, like, sometimes the laws are unjust. Sometimes the things that people do are understandable. The causes of sin, like you were talking about, Joseph, that sometimes people are forced by circumstances into things that are less than ideal. And if they had more opportunity or more education, then they wouldn't do those things. But there's no indication that's the case for the innkeeper and his wife. They're just terrible people, and they enjoy being terrible people, is what it seems like, especially in this version. They are just having a blast being the worst people ever.
I like this portrayal of the Thénardiers. They were hilarious. That was some good casting choices.
Yeah, I really like them. They're a lot of fun, obviously, in the musical, just being like the most horrible, slimy villains that they can possibly think of. I feel like in a lot of musicals and plays, being the bad guy is the most fun role to have. So I definitely can see that they were enjoying them. Thematically, I think Hugo put them in to serve as the exact illustration of what you were saying, the opposite of Jean Valjean. The Thénardiers start as prosperous innkeepers, and over the course of the plot, they commit worse and worse crimes because they feel that they need them to get along, and they just get poorer and poorer.
I think, though, it's fun to play the villain in a play. It can be fun to ham it up, but I like that this doesn't ever make them a desirable character to be. It's not, say, Paradise Lost, where Satan's the most interesting character. The good people in Les Mis are interesting people, which is a plus for it in moral literary thinking. It's fun to act as the bad people, but they are not interesting people because they don't really change. They are just terrible and outlandish the whole time. And Jean Valjean and Fantine and Javert are all much more interesting and complex people who are trying to do what's right and succeeding or failing.
If you want a really good version of the Les Mis that I think does a better job of talking about these issues of mercy and justice and law and righteousness, I'm just going to put a little plug in for the 1998 movie version starring Geoffrey Rush and Liam Neeson as Javert and Valjean, respectively. I thought that was a great sort of, again, in that spectrum I outlined earlier, that's the one that's just pure movie adaptation. And I remember watching it and thinking, oh, I thought this was going to be the musical, but this is just the story. So that was disappointing. But once I readjusted my attitude towards what I was watching, that's a good one that I think does a better job of especially juxtaposing Valjean and Javert than I think this 2012 musical version does. They're just going for different things. And so if you want to see the good cinematic discussion of all the heady themes of mercy and justice and all of that, I thought the 1998 version was quite good on that front.
All right, so we're going to move into our rating segment now. We give everything we watch 3 ratings. The first rating is for content, which is like for objectionable material on a scale of celestial, terrestrial, telestial, outer darkness. There are a few scenes that might bother parents to show kids. I don't think there's anything inappropriate for adults. There's the main thing that I always hear people say is like, why did they put in the bad Santa scene in the Master of the House song? People are annoyed at that one.
The older I get, the less concerned I am by that kind of thing. And just to be honest, I used to, when I was in college, I worked for a paper called the Entertainment Research Report, where it was my job to go in and count the number of swear words in movies and release that. And I used to have to write them down in the dark. And I was dating my wife at the time, and she flipped open my Franklin Day Planner and found all these bad words and went, "What is wrong with you? Who is this guy?" In terms of content, I don't see anything in the content that is inconsistent with what I think people would expect, knowing what Les Mis is. I think this is a known commodity, and so I think anybody walking into it is going to recognize that there's going to be challenging material. And if they're not willing to do that, if they haven't done enough homework beforehand to recognize that's what Les Mis is, then I just think that's silly on their part. If you love Les Mis, if you know the musical, there's nothing in here that is going to come as a shock to you.
I agree. I don't think it's necessarily objectionable in the abstract. I thought they showed too much in the Fantine scenes. Hugo was very careful not to show anything humiliating in the writing of the book because he felt it was degrading to the dignity of his subjects, the poor. And I agree with that perspective. And so from an artistic perspective, I don't think it added anything. So I would have preferred they left some of that out. I don't think it's necessarily objectionable in the abstract, though. So it certainly adds somewhat to the immediacy of the understanding of the degradation that is happening there. But I feel like it does sacrifice some dignity on the part of the subjects.
I think I'd agree with all of these sentiments. To use the story we've all heard about, the rattlesnake, you knew what this was when you picked it up, and nothing is out of place. I think I do agree with Joseph, though. To me, the one scene where Fantine is engaged in relations with one of her clients, Anne Hathaway's just doing the 1,000-yard stare off into space while, you know, the action is happening, is a moment to see how far she's fallen and how terrible this is for her. But I don't think it was strictly necessary, and so I try to balance it that way. So I don't know what I want to give this on our scale of celestial, terrestrial, celestial, utter darkness. I feel like the rating should just be like, you knew what this was when you picked it up. That's my rating.
I will agree. This is one that shows the limitations of our rating system, for sure. I'm going to disagree with you guys about the Fantine scene. I thought it was necessary, and I thought it was tastefully done. When I was getting ready to rewatch it, people were like, oh, there's just the bad Santa scene and the Fantine scene. And I was actually bothered more by the bad Santa than I was by the Fantine scene, because I felt like the Fantine scene is trying to make you as the viewer experience what that is like for her. To go from being a factory worker, within the course of one song, she is down in the gutter. And that experience is very intense. And so for that reason, I would say we do have to think, especially for children, not for adults, but for children, I would think, you need to make sure they are ready for that kind of intensity of experience. It's not as shiny as the musical version is. When you go and see it in a theater, that she's singing this very dramatic song about how life killed her dream. This is very immediate and real and experiential, which is good for building empathy. But consider not making it your missionary son's first film after his mission. Consider the maturity of your teenager before you show them this film. Whether they can handle that kind of intense emotion and intense sadness for the state of the human condition. So maybe we just won't give a rating on this one, but just be thoughtful and aware of the content that is in there. And I really could have done without the 3 seconds of that Santa scene. I really could have. Our next rating is for artistic merit, skillful use of craft. Is this a good film as a film? And we use a scale of 1 to 5 popcorn balls.
Reiterating what I said before, that there are a spectrum of how you could present this story, all the way from pure musical to just pure film adaptation. And this one's right in the middle. I think I'm going to give this one 4 popcorn balls, just because the music is not as good as I would have wanted. Anne Hathaway's great. I'm not sure everybody else rises quite to her level. Maybe Amanda Seyfried, but the rest of them, and certainly Russell Crowe, I'm sorry, God bless you. You're not a very good singer in this instance. I know Russell Crowe has a band, and so he performs a lot, and he knows how to sing, but something about the live action nature of the singing in this one, he did not capture that very well. I feel like if you would cast better singers, the problems I would have had with the music would have been largely fixed, I think. but they got celebrities to do it. And I think for a lot of those cases, that didn't work out as well. To have Wolverine, who I think wanted to do song and dance sort of stuff all the time, but poor Hugh Jackman got tricked into playing Wolverine for 25 years because he got this one part. Hugh Jackman does a pretty good job, and because he's a marvelous singer as well, but it worked better with some people than others. Actually, I think both of the actors doing the Thénardiers did a fantastic job. So I'm going to give it 4 popcorn balls just because the music wasn't quite as on point. And again, I recognize that was a genre choice to have them singing it live as opposed to dubbing over it, but it is what it is. So I'm going to give it 4 popcorn balls. The acting was amazing, though, and puts you in the immediacy of the characters in a way that no other film musical has ever done, to my mind.
I largely agree. I think that as an artistic piece, it does its job pretty well within the limitations of the medium, but I was not as impressed by the singing either. 4 popcorn balls for me as well. Not a whole lot more to contribute here.
Jim, what are your thoughts? You're the most musical theatery of us.
And I'm going to be the skunk at the party.
Do it.
I'm going to give it 2 popcorn balls, and I think that's being generous on my part to some degree. I don't really have an issue with the performances per se, other than maybe Russell Crowe, although he gives it the old college try. I think this was a poor adaptation of the source material. I think the decision to sing live was so constantly distracting that it just made it very difficult for me to be invested in the story, in the way it works. I think it's a failed experiment, maybe a noble experiment, but it did not work for me. I love musicals, and usually I rewatch musicals on a regular basis. And this is not one that I have felt compelled to rewatch. I just never really felt entirely engaged. There are exceptions to that. Certainly Anne Hathaway's unbelievable few moments that earn her an Oscar were stunning. But I just felt like the decision to do this and to take the kind of artifice from a musical and make it gritty and real, it just didn't work. And hence my parsimonious popcorn ball judgment.
I'm going to split the difference and say, as a film, I would have given it 4. As a musical, I would give it 2. So I'm going to give it a 3. I just think the musical parts of it didn't work. A lot of the acting and the grittiness and the immediacy really adds to the empathy building nature of the films. Just probably some poor choices from the beginning. So I would give it 3 popcorn balls.
That's fair.
Final rating is for Gospel Connections and morally edifying messages. Like we've been discussing this whole time, Les Mis is a deeply moral, deeply spiritual story. So I think we got to give it 5 apricots from me.
Regardless of the adaptation, the basic source material is that strong. It is that powerful. And whatever spiritual edification people pull from this, it's coming from Victor Hugo, I think, more than it's coming from the medium that is being used to tell that story. But the story is powerful enough that I think 5 apricots, I think that's appropriate.
Joseph, your thoughts? You're the big fan of the book.
I have a hard time with this because I feel like the movie and the musical really fall short compared to the book.
So we'll give 6 apricots to the book.
Sure, I'll give the movie 5 apricots because standing all alone, just on the merits, it is a very spiritual and uplifting story, but the execution is just so limited compared to what Hugo's able to accomplish in the book. I'm a great partisan of the book. I think everyone should read it. It's my favorite book in the world, but also it's really big, so I understand why people are intimidated by it. But if that is a problem, read the abridged version. I promise you will not regret it.
Take us home, Carl.
So I think I agree that the strength of the moral messages come from the original source material, not so much this adaptation. If anything, this is actually something I found disappointing is because they're just racing through some of this stuff. It's like you point out, Liz, it's very powerful to see in the course of one song, Fantine go from the sort of lower middle class life to the absolute despair depths of being a prostitute in the filthy gutter there in France. But it goes so fast that I feel like the best way to approach this is not almost as its own thing, but to approach it as another way of looking at Les Mis. Because you're going to encounter this someday. You're going to take Joseph's advice, or maybe your high school English teacher will assign you to read the abridged version, or you're going to encounter the story, or you're going to watch a different movie, or you're going to listen to the soundtrack from the Broadway play. You're going to encounter this some way in your life, probably. And this is just another way of turning it over in your hand and looking at it from a different angle and a different point of view. And so I'll give it 5 apricots as well. But again, that comes from the strength of the source material, which I saw through a different lens because of this movie. And I felt I benefited from it.
All right. You can follow my writing and book reviews on lizbusby.com. Carl, where can people find you?
I'm on Twitter at Carl Cranny. You can come say hi there and have a chat if you'd like.
Joseph, where can people find your work online or get in touch with you?
I do have a Twitter. If you want to follow me, it's at Georges Joseph. It's deactivated a bunch of the time, so equivocal whether you'll find me there. But yeah, that's about it. I also sometimes write for my publication called Progress in Poverty, which is on Substack, but that rarely has anything to do with these kinds of topics. It's about political economy.
You're on a great episode of our friend Ben Puccini's podcast, Radical Civility, talking about Georgism, too. If people want to know more political stuff from you, that's a good place to check it out. Jim, what have you been working on? Where can people find you?
I've got my own podcast called Inside Out with Jim Bennett and Ian Wilkes, where I discuss my former missionary buddy who's now out of the church. We talk about the church from the inside and from the outside. So I invite people to take a listen to that wherever they get their podcasts. I'm on Twitter at stalloncornell.com. That has a long, weird story behind it, but that's where you can find me on Twitter. It's where Desnat beats up on me on a daily basis.
Oh, Twitter. We will put links to those in the show notes if people want to follow up with our guests and learn more about their views. Thank you for joining us this week. If you've enjoyed this episode, share the podcast with a friend who enjoys good movies and good conversation. You can also subscribe to our podcast on the platform of your choice or on YouTube. We'd love to hear your thoughts on this episode or any episode via email, social media, or on our website. It makes our day as hosts to hear from you. We're going to be taking a summer break after this episode to spend some time with our families, a new baby in Carl's case, but we'll be in your podcast feeds again in the fall, so keep an eye out for us then. This has been Pop Culture on the Apricot Tree, encouraging you to seek after everything virtuous, lovely, of good report, or praiseworthy. We'll see you next time.
I'm JC.
Hey, I'm Scott. Welcome to Family Bro Evening.
We're members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, looking to understand and break down some of those confusing LDS beliefs and culture quirks.
In other words, we ain't your bishop's fireside.
Our podcast is all about LDS beliefs and doctrine.
We want to present a rational discussion on our beliefs, debunk some myths, explore the culture, and ask the hard questions.
We hope you'll join us in this journey, learn something new, and hopefully have a little bit of fun.
Join us every 2 weeks wherever you find podcasts.